From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Is Michigan headed for a very long election night?
I don't really believe that elections is something that we want to just see if something fails before we address the problem.
A bill to give local clerks a head start on ballot counting has hit a wall. We'll hear from one clerk who's back to the drawing board. Also, the governor's plan for road repairs. Plan B, as Gretchen Whitmer calls it, involves a big offering of state bonds for funding. We'll talk through how it would work and whether it's a complete solution.
It's a one-time thing, right? And so a few years down the road, we're going to be exactly where we're at right now, which is talking about how are we going to fund these roads.
And we'll introduce you to the composer and DJ responsible for the new sound of Stateside. He'll talk about finding the sweet spot in a new piece of music.
You can sit there and nitpick at it all day and add and change, but sometimes you just have to know it feels good and enjoy it.
All that's coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, we're going to dig a little deeper into Governor Whitmer's $3.5 billion bond proposal, what she's been referring to as her Plan B to start fixing the roads. But first, as you've been hearing since the start of the year, Michigan's elections are going through some changes. Absentee ballots are now available on demand, and that means a flood of votes mailed in to city and county clerks well ahead of Election Day. Now, by law, the clerks cannot open the ballots, prepare them, or count them until the same day when everybody else votes in person. State Senator Ruth Johnson, who we spoke to earlier this month, proposed a package of changes, including some early ballot preparation, to keep the clerks from having a very long election night. But State Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey, a top Republican lawmaker, said yesterday that he's not going to support that bill. Riley Beggins covers politics for Bridge Michigan, and she joins us now. Riley, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, glad to be here.
We should probably explain what we mean when we're talking about ballot preparation. How have you heard clerks describing this?
Yeah, so when clerks receive absentee ballots, they're coming in some packaging. There's an outside envelope that's it's mailed in, and then also a secrecy envelope inside, and then the ballot is folded up. So it sounds simple, but their concern is that on election day, when they are unpackaging these ballots, it's going to take time to do each one of these, especially if we're going to have significantly more than we have had in the past.
Just to be 500% clear, we're not talking about counting the votes early, at least not at this point, just about the ballot preparation, right?
Yep, exactly.
So you talked to Senator Mike Shirkey about why he does not support this this package of ideas from State Senator Ruth Johnson, meaning to say giving clerks a chance to start preparing those ballots early, among some other reforms. What did he tell you about why he doesn't think that's a good idea?
So he basically said this is a slippery slope to early voting. If we are able to process ballots, he said counting ballots, even though these bill packages would not allow for that, but that early counting of ballots would eventually lead to early voting, which he thinks is a problem and could cause some security concerns.
Right. You talked to Senator Shirkey also about the volumes that the clerks are expecting. Do we know at this point much about how many people are trying to mail in an absentee ballot?
Yeah, so we know that it's significantly up over the same time in 2016. The Secretary of State said about 60% more people have requested absentee ballots. And then for people who have actually received those, it's almost twice as many already. So we're going to see quite a bit more people. And that's going to make a bigger difference in those larger municipalities where we have just a higher volume of folks.
Right. Now, in this situation, absent a plan to let the clerks go at the ballots early and at least start preparing them, did Mike Shirkey say how he thinks the piles of early votes that are coming in should be dealt with?
He basically said we should let them figure it out. We're not going to solve this problem before it becomes a problem. So that may mean that if we have a disastrous primary day, really, really late results, or people in the clerk's office working for 40 hours, as Senator Johnson has said may happen, that they'll be on alert to do something before the November general election.
Let's pull back and look at the math here. Mike Shirky is a Republican. So is Senator Ruth Johnson, who proposed the reforms. And so are a number of clerks that have said that they need more time to deal with the ballots and their preparation. Just to pull back, the state's top elections official, Jocelyn Benson, is a Democrat. Have you had any sense that having a Democratic Secretary of State changes the conversation?
I mean, Johnson has changed her tune on this, I guess, a little bit since the year has started, and that she's supporting this, and that's generally aligned with what Secretary of State Benson wants. I would say that Benson has been pushing for to go further than Johnson has, even. You know, she says that we should be able to fully process these ballots. We should be able to take them out of both of those envelopes I mentioned, unfold them, and prepare them. And Johnson just wants to do that first step.
Riley Beggins is a reporter for Bridge Magazine. Riley, thanks for checking in with us.
Thanks so much.
For some reaction to yesterday's developments, we're going to go back to someone who was sounding the alarm a bit earlier this winter about the possibility of a long election 2020 recount. It's Ottawa County Clerk Justin Roebuck, and he joins us today on Stateside. Justin, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Did you have a chance to see some of Senator Shirky's comments?
I did. And from the perspective of election administrators, I think, you know, we really believe that this process can be done in a secure manner. Security is absolutely the utmost priority for us in the election administration field. And I think, you know, I understand and I empathize with Senator Shirky and with others in the legislature who may have concerns regarding that. And I think what we are hoping for is a great conversation about how we can build that security into the process and assure that security for the tabulation of our ballots.
Senator Shirky says that we shouldn't be trying to solve a problem that hasn't happened yet. What do you think of that approach?
You know, election administrators are planners. We like to be able to predict as much as possible. And in this scenario and situation, I believe we have a lot of data to run a pretty accurate prediction. And so from this sense of both the security and the integrity of our elections, I don't really believe that, you know, elections is something that we want to just see if something fails before we address a problem. I think there's enough evidence that there may be a concern and a problem in order for us to take some steps and some actions ahead of time to prevent that. And I think that's ultimately way better for our voters and for the security and integrity of our process.
The main issue that Senator Shirky is raising publicly about an early count or even just early ballot preparation is that it creates a security risk to allow clerks to start working with the envelopes ahead of time. Do you think that's true?
Well, I understand the concerns, and I think we really should be. It's our job, you know, as administrators or as people approaching this subject and requesting this change, I think it's our job to address the security concerns. And Senator Johnson, frankly, you won't find a stronger proponent of election security. And I think that we do have an ability and a process in place that would allow these ballots to be secured and also counted in a timely fashion. There are other concerns with security that I have regarding the timeliness of getting unofficial results out to the public. And I think it's been interesting, you know, we've been having this conversation in recent days that we may not really even need to worry about getting results out on election night. And is it really that important to have results on election night? And I think for a couple of factors, it really is. When you allow the timeliness to lag, it creates a vacuum of information. And a lot of times that information is filled with misinformation. As we've seen in Iowa, when the results were delayed, which were obviously for very different reasons you know, you look at that, and unfortunately, that does have an effect on the confidence level that voters have in the process, and that is certainly something that, as election administrators, we want to avoid.
You mentioned Senator Ruth Johnson, who is the sponsor of the bill. She's a Republican. You, although you work on a nonpartisan job, you are a Republican yourself. Is there anything that you want to say to legislators in your party, including Senator Shirky, also a Republican, about this issue?
Yeah, you know, I think I have a lot of respect for my fellow Republicans in the legislature. We work together on so many issues, and they have been very supportive of the process. And I know from experience that, you know, these are folks who really do care about the legitimacy and the integrity of our process. And I would just say that as election administrators, you will not find another a group of people who care more about the integrity and the security of the process. And I think it's important to allow for that conversation to happen. And I think this package of bills by Senator Johnson is one tool in the toolbox of options that we may have for dealing with this influx of absentee ballots. You know, another great opportunity would be some supplemental funding for the purchase of additional equipment, for example, that would also allow for a more timely process. But I do think that, you know, we also need to look at the security from the standpoint of errors that could occur. You know, I think I heard in college once that nothing really great happens at midnight. And I think the same can be said when it comes to election results and tallying election results. I think it's fair and reasonable to say, you know, we want election workers tallying these results or processing these ballots who have been well rested, you know, who have not worked a 20-hour shift, who are prepared and able and much less prone to error. And I think that's an important piece of the puzzle as well.
Justin Roebuck is the clerk for Ottawa County. Justin, good to talk to you. Thanks for making the time.
Thanks so much, April. I appreciate it.
After a break, one of our favorite crate diggers talks about the music that lifts and inspires him right now.
The weight of the rock and roll world is on Bo Diddley. Everybody knows the songs of Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Fats Domino. Bo Diddley is known mostly by reputation. His records aren't as well known, and I've always thought that was a crime.
We check in with the co-owner of Encore Records in Ann Arbor next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In 2020, we would like to remind you of the importance of taking a break. We're kind of reminding ourselves about that as well. To that end, periodically this year, we're going to be inviting some folks from Michigan record stores that we love to talk to us about what they're listening to. We begin today with His Eminence, Jim Dwyer, the co-owner of Encore Records, serving Michigan listeners for more than 60 years, albeit, Jim, not under the same ownership. I should say that.
That's correct.
Right. Welcome.
Thank you.
I just wanted to start out by asking you how you and the staff solve the question of what to listen to in this store.
Well, at Encore Records, we're pretty democratic about it. The first guy there puts a record on or a CD and everybody gets a turn, and it loops back around so that sometimes you have to wait a little while for your turn. If there's four of us there, you've got to wait for everybody to get their pick. But everybody gets a pick, and everybody gets a turn.
Do you ever find yourself in a situation where there has to be a conflict resolution model?
Well, sometimes somebody will be a little antsy to get their pick on and will, oh, it's my turn? No, not yet. You can be quite assertive about, hey, wait a minute, I haven't had a pick yet. That occasionally happens, but, you know, just a little stepping on toes, no. No hurt feelings.
It's nice that these things can be resolved without coming to blows.
Sure.
What do you have that's new that you're listening to these days?
Well, the first thing that came to mind is the brand new record by the Heliocentrics. They're an interesting British sort of jazz, funk, hip-hop influenced combo. They've got a brand new record on Madlib's label. They're an in-house favorite at Encore.
There's so much fascinating stuff coming out of London these days. And I got to say, your pick of this track gets me out of my Shabaka Hutchings sense of comfort zone very nicely. Do you want to tell us anything about this band?
Well, I wish they would tour. They've been putting out records for a few years now. Bill McClelland, my business partner, introduced me to this band a few years back with whatever their latest record was at that time. And they just sound so good. They're very well recorded. And that's, you know, what we always say about, you know, vinyl LPs that's so good is that they really convey the sense of the acoustic space within the room in which it was recorded rather than just a bunch of zeros and ones, sort of smoothing out all the edges. Distinctive studios have distinctive sounds. You know, there's a reason why the room itself is important.
Let's take a listen. This is the Heliocentrics off Infinity of Now with Light in the Dark. Kashti kruka kuri kracha to jest tutaj zmienia świat sila sama a ty sąka rozwinięsza każdy kwiat skrócisz jego sort of like there's some Ennio Morricone by way of the Velvet Underground going on there.
Yeah. They don't usually have this much singing on their records, but it's sort of spooky and otherworldly.
The band's drummer, Malcolm Caddo, is kind of the one whose sensibility drives the band. How would you describe what he's going for?
It's sort of, you know, it's in the pocket drumming like James Brown's drummers always tried to do. It's more funk than jazz. So it's got the propulsive, you know, motion forward rather than sort of the sideways rhythmic explorations of a jazz drummer.
At the same time, that incredible downward spiraling momentum all throughout the track.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. You know, sometimes listening to this, I wonder if there are bands that are just making records for sampling.
Well, yeah, the Heliocentrics would be a good source for sampling. I always say at this point, you know, so many records have been sampled that it's probably true that somebody is out there making records just for sampling, but I'm waiting for people to start sampling more oddball things like certain classical records or even comedy records. There's samples everywhere.
I see you brought us something a little older today, too. What do you have?
The second album by the mighty Bo Diddley, which is my dad's all-time favorite musical artist, and so I grew up listening to Bo Diddley from a tender young age. For me personally, the Beatles are my favorite group and always will be. But the weight of the rock and roll world is on Bo Diddley. Everybody knows the songs of Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Fats Domino. Bo Diddley is known mostly by reputation. His records aren't as well known, and I've always thought that was a crime.
What's this track called?
This track is called You Don't Love Me, You Don't Care. And the reason I picked this one off of many, many great songs on his first three albums is because this is the bluesiest number I think he ever did. But it's electric, and there's a harmonica solo that goes so hot that it starts to sound like feedback, and there is an element of feedback going on. You know, no Bo Diddley, there's no Jimi Hendrix, as far as like manipulating the sound of guitars, and he had different shaped guitars and a fur-covered guitar and just a badass kind of a guy and cool. So this song just is a good example of how the room itself is part of the sound, and also how in that era, this was recorded in 1959, a lot of these engineers were mixing live. The needles are right in the red, and if it goes a little bit too higher, it's too hot, but they're like mixing it live, and you can feel the energy in the session. It's just phenomenal.
Jim Dwyer, I can't believe you brought this record. The very first concert I ever went to as a ticket-buying teenager was Bo Diddley.
Oh, very good. Yeah. That's a great boast to be able to make.
Oh, it's not a boast. I was too dumb to know how great it was going to be.
I was lucky enough to see him live once as well myself. So.
Everything I knew about him I'd gotten from Nike commercials pretty much at that point.
Yeah, I remember that advertising campaign.
Right. This would have been in the early 90s. And he just was an amazing live performer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I have to mention that fabulous piano solo by uncredited by Otis Spann, for whom a park was once named in this town. It's, you know, sadly was never official. It's now currently the soccer field of Ann Arbor's Huron High School. It was once named Otis Spann Memorial Park.
Oh, wow.
Maybe it's the original site of the Jazz and Blues Fest.
Maybe they should just blare Otis Spann tracks over the speakers there in all seasons. That would make me perfectly happy.
Yeah, Otis Spann's on a ton of anything recorded at Chess that has piano on it is probably Otis Spann.
You know, it's all the more amazing listening to that track and realizing what you were saying about it being mixed live. I mean, going from the vocal to the harmonica solo to the piano break and just sort of figuring out all that on the fly.
You know, I'm sure it was a pretty primitive mixer.
And whoever did it just killed it.
Yeah, goosebumps. Well,
if you're just joining us, my guest is Jim Dwyer. He's the co-owner of Encore Records in Ann Arbor. What's the third track you brought for us today?
Well, I didn't play any Beatles. I mentioned they're my favorite group. Everybody knows the Beatles for good reason. So I went with another top favorite of mine, and that's the great Brian Eno, pioneer of sound manipulation and the studio as instrument. He's not the inventor of a lot of the techniques that he has mastered and elevated, but boy, he's made some great and hugely influential records. And My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, which he made with Talking Head David Byrne in 1981, is my all-time favorite record. And so I selected the opening track, which is called America is Waiting. And I have to mention that for listeners who don't know this, who aren't already familiar with the recording, that this is analog tape sampling. This is before digital sampling. And what they did was they recorded Byrne and Eno,
recorded voices off of the radio, talk radio. And this is the beginning of the explosion of talk radio in the early 80s, which, of course, we're inundated with in a certain sense today. It used to be just music programming, and then talk radio became a thing. And so what they did was took a razor blade and magnetic tape and cut up the tape to fit the music they were making. And this was a recording they got off the radio, and America is Waiting is what it's called.
Awesome. Let's take a listen.
America is waiting for a message of some sort or another.
Rubbery beats, the crunchy melodic touches in there, making you want to dance, but rather uncomfortably so.
Yeah, there's a spookiness to it, and there's the slashing guitars.
Definitely hearing the David Byrne influence there, but I don't know if that's immediately recognizable as a Brian Eno tune.
Well, he's funkier than people give him credit for. And his assembling of, you know, all the, you know, all-star musicians who are on it, Busta Jones and Robert Fripp and et cetera, et cetera. Other tracks on the record get into radio voices from Africa and the Middle East. When that record came out, and by the way, the little cracklies you heard at the beginning, that's my original copy from, I should have brought a cleaner copy along.
Oh,
I
wow.
suppose. That's my original copy from 1981 when I was just graduating from high school. This record opened the door to Arabic singing for me, and some of the other tracks on the record led me to explore avenues I had never even considered.
You mentioned that this album, the album that this came from, is your all-time favorite. Hmm. That kind of surprises me for a Beatles man. Why is this one top of the list for you?
Well, it's huge influence. A lot of artists that like MIA, for example, when she started doing records, I thought, this is the continuation of what Bush of Ghosts began. A sort of a polyglot, you know, world music, funkiness in a blender.
She's a London-based Sri Lankan-British artist.
Who uses, you know, sort of R&B funk and sampling and electronic music.
Very effectively.
All blended together into a new amalgam. The sonic textures of Bush of Ghosts. It's a headphone record. It's a record you can dance to. It's not a lot of Eno records you can dance to. So it among my circle of friends growing up in Jackson, we were a bunch of kooky, artistic outsider types. This became like a party classic record for us.
You know, David Byrne did a solo record that got turned into an explosive stage show that toured and even had a run on Broadway called American Utopia.
Oh, right.
And it's just him and a band performing and moving constantly around the stage with no wires in a super choreographed way. Do you see some of the lyric and thematic ideas that he was working on at the early stage in the career manifesting later?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say. I haven't followed David Byrne's solo career as closely as I have continued to stick with Brian Eno. But the record I would go to would be his Catherine Wheel record, which was a dance performance for Twyla Tharp. That's an amazing, if you've seen the footage of the performance of David Byrne's Catherine Wheel. So he has explored the physicality of music in a way, as you mentioned, the nonstop motion of his live shows. It's interesting. Eno is more the cerebral one. He's into the influence of smell on memory. Eno's sort of a more internal cerebral guy, and David Byrne, for all of his, you know, nerdly gawkiness,
he's in the world.
He's in the world, very much in the world, and is the physicality. Things are in constant motion with David Byrne, and that's one of his, you know, great charms.
Jim, thanks for bringing us the stuff you've been listening to. I think some of us set foot over the doorstep of record stores constantly mindful of the scene in High Fidelity, where Jack Black plays an unbelievable unbearably opinionated record store employee who just delights in taking apart customers who request what he considers to be bad music. Mm-hmm. Is the record store still a safe space?
Yeah, you know, I always say music is the place where everybody gets to be right, because whatever you love is great music. And it doesn't matter what other people think about it. You know, I love my music. People used to think, oh, he listens to weird stuff. He listens to stuff nobody's ever heard of. So I was used to people sort of looking down on my music, or even, you know, as a Beatles fan in the 70s, oh, that's old. Nobody listens to that anymore. So I know what it's like to have my music judged. So, you know, there are artists that I think, well, those are not great records. But you never tell people that, because it's, you know, raining on their parade. They like what they like. And we see ourselves in Encore as sort of the caretakers of music itself. And whatever you like, we've got some. And if you like this singer or that kind of music, we'll help you find it. No judgment. We want people to enjoy music and allow music to bring some pleasure to their life.
Jim Dwyer of Encore Records, thanks for digging the crates for us.
Thank you very much.
Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Up next on the show. Now, how is this going to work exactly? We're going to discuss Governor Whitmer's road bond proposal with an expert in public finance. She's going to break it all down for us. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Governor Gretchen Whitmer is moving forward with her plan to use a $3.5 billion package of bonds as a first step in fixing Michigan's crumbling roads. During her State of the State address last month, Governor Whitmer acknowledged the impasse she'd reached with Republican legislative leaders on prior funding plans.
And so it's time for Plan B, executive action. Tomorrow, I will ask the State Transportation Commission to issue state road bonds so we can start fixing the roads now. My Rebuilding Michigan plan is financed without an increase at the gas pump. Since it doesn't require the legislature to act, we can get started right away.
Some critics of the governor have suggested bonds may or may not be the appropriate tool for long-term repair of Michigan's infrastructure. Since most of us still have a few gaps in our knowledge of how bonds work, we've invited Stephanie Leiser in. She's an expert in public finance and a lecturer at the U of M's Ford School of Public Policy. She is currently working with the Department of Treasury on local communities and their fiscal health. Professor Leiser, thanks for coming in to help us through this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's discuss Governor Whitmer's options. There are different kinds of municipal bonds, aren't there?
Yep. The ones we're looking at in this proposal are called revenue bonds, which means that they are going to be financed and backed with a pledge of constitutionally protected revenue sources, the gas tax, registration fees. So they have a specific revenue source associated with them.
So you have to start with this pool of money to guarantee the bonds and then invite investors to invest in the bonds, which then becomes the money that you use for whatever project you've chosen, right?
Right. So that's when investors come and look at the bonds, they see that this is the source that they will be repaid from.
Who invests in such things?
Oh, all kinds of people. I think municipal bonds are generally held by households, pension funds, mutual funds. So it's a pretty broad variety of investors.
They draw a diverse class of people wanting to buy in.
Yes.
And would you say that they're generally attractive as being pretty stable?
Yeah, bonds in general, and municipal bonds in particular, are viewed as a pretty safe investment. So, you know, when people are looking to diversify their portfolio, this would be kind of the counterbalance to maybe some stocks or more risky investments.
Right. What are some projects that Michigan has issued bonds for in recent history?
Michigan issues bonds all the time for lots of different things, roads being one, any kind of capital project. So the schools will issue bonds at the local level. Universities will issue bonds. We'll issue bonds for building projects, all kinds of different infrastructure projects. So it's a very common financing tool.
Why are they favored for things like big capital projects and used less frequently for needs that have ongoing costs associated with them?
Well, when you're thinking about how to finance something, you can either finance it out of your current resources, in which case those would just be, you know, your projects would essentially be expenses, or you could finance it using bonds. And the reason to use bonds is to think about projects that have long-term costs and benefits. So you're, by stretching the repayment period out over time, you're sort of matching up the cost side of things with the benefit side of things. So something like roads or buildings, they have a long life. And so you can match up the costs and benefits over time.
Is there much of a record either in former Governor Rick Snyder's administration or former Governor Jennifer Granholm's administration in using them for something other than a capital project?
In generally speaking, states are not allowed to bond for other than capital projects. Most states have what are called balanced budget requirements, which means your annual budget has to be, revenues and expenses have to be balanced. So at the state and local level, bonding is really more just for capital projects. At the federal level, of course, they issue treasury bonds to cover annual deficits.
Right. The amount that Governor Whitmer is proposing to bond for, $3.5 billion, that's like something approaching one-third of the state's general fund. Does that represent any kind of new precedent?
It's definitely the largest road bonding project that the state would have done before, but the state has had a long history of doing bonds for road projects. So this would definitely be a larger in the scale, but not without, I mean, the process of doing it is the same.
Can you explain sort of how the, it's not as if there's a federal agency that comes to states and says, you're bonding too much, you can't do this anymore. What part of the system represents a check on the state's bonding possibilities?
Yeah, so the state statute governs how much debt can be taken on. And the way they do that is through how much of the funds that come in can be used for debt service. So the current statutory limit, I think, is 50%, but I think state policy actually lowers that to 25%. So they say we can't spend more than 25% of the revenues coming in on debt service for debts that we have outstanding. Where we're at right now is that we are quite significantly below that limit. And I know that's one of the reasons the governor has mentioned it's a good time to do it is because we have that extra capacity to take on new debt.
I know we're pretty far into the weeds of what is usually the purview of the legislature's budget writing committees, but obviously this was a big move for the governor. Mm-hmm. How would you rate the relative level of risk that she's proposing at this point? I mean, would it be akin to taking out a line of equity on your home and then using it for something like tax payments?
No. Generally speaking, when you're taking out bonds like this, you want to use them for capital projects that are going to have value over time and give you a positive return on your investment once you've actually accounted for all the costs of building and the debt service and operating and maintenance. So this is a very standard way of doing things. I don't want to misrepresent this as a particularly risky thing to do. And in fact, I would say it's, you know, on a much smaller scale than what she's proposed just last year with the new gas tax. So, she kind of characterized last year's plan to increase the gas tax. That was plan A, and this is plan B. I think of it more as like this is a plan A light. You know, it's much smaller in scale and scope and dollar value. So
it's less money overall than the 45-cent a gallon increase on the gas tax would have raised.
Right. The gas tax increase would have raised, I think, about $2 billion plus a year, and that would be an annual revenue source. So you can use that on an ongoing basis for new projects each year. This is a one-time source of money. So you use it for the pool of projects that you have, you know, in the queue right now. And after that, you have to go back and you can either bond more at that point. You're back to square one in terms of how do we find an ongoing, sustainable revenue source for the road. So,
of course, the advantages for this path include the fact that the governor can do so without getting legislative approval. And you've mentioned the disadvantages, that it does kick the can down the road a bit. Yeah. Do you see any other possible disadvantages to going forward with this as the next step in road fix funding?
Well, I think you hit the really important point, which is it's a one-time thing, right? And so a few years down the road, we're going to be exactly where we're at right now, which is talking about how are we going to fund these roads. And so $3.5 billion will get you part of the way. It'll accelerate projects that are already kind of in line to be done. But once we do those, you know, these are only state projects. It doesn't address anything about local roads and the money flowing through to locals. So, you know, yes, it's something she can do right now. She doesn't have to deal with the legislature. Interest rates are low. There's a lot of good reasons to do something, but I fear that this isn't, you know, it's not going to be enough. And so if people think that this is a substitute for what the governor proposed last year, I think everybody's going to be disappointed.
Stephanie Leiser with the University of Michigan's Ford School of Public Policy. Thanks very much for coming in and talking with us.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
The music cue that you just heard, we like to call that the heartbeat of the stateside theme music. That song and our new sound was composed by Ann Arbor Ypsilanti native Kendall Tucker, who performs under the name 14KT. KT lives in Los Angeles and joins us now from California. KT, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you so much. It feels good
right.
to be here. I'm smiling right now.
I can hear it. You had a traditional music education in piano and upright bass, but I understand that your performing career started with writing rhymes and performing more as an MC. When did you start thinking about building hip-hop tracks sort of as composition?
I think it was like a natural progression. You know, I just loved hip-hop music when I was young. You know, I listened to hip-hop in the 80s, actually. You know, I'm a little bit older. And then when it got to the 90s, I started to create the things that I love. So I just started to just play around and write rhymes and with my friends. And after a while, you want to get better. You start studying all the classic songs that you listen to that you like, and then you just kind of try to emulate them. So that's kind of where it starts. Like, you want to emulate them until you find your own voice.
What were your tools when you were getting started?
All I had was a dual tape deck. That's it. You know, when I started production, I did what they call now. We didn't know what they were called back then, but they were called pause tapes. And these tapes where you just take a dual cassette tape deck.
On the old boombox.
Yeah, on the old boombox with the little mic jack on there.
Yes.
And I would just, you know, I would just kind of like rap into headphones, broken headphones. And I would just rap over different beats that I would record off the radio or records or something on a cassette. And that's kind of all the equipment I had.
You have some relatively recent work that came out in May in the form of the album For My Sanity. But the track that we've obviously been playing a lot around here is the new Stateside theme song.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about composing a track and breaking it down for us. When you sit down to put tracks together, could you talk a little bit about how do you layer different sounds?
How do I layer sounds? I usually start with what I call skeletons. They're like skeleton tracks where it will be very minimal. It might just be me playing a piano, and I might have like a drum rhythm, and I'll play bass, you know, like a bass line, just to kind of bring out the melody a little bit more. And I'll leave it there and kind of sit with the idea and think about what other instruments would fill the space or sound good filling the space. And once I think of those instruments, then I try to think of a friend of mine, or if it's something I can play, or someone I know and what style they have of playing that would fit with the rest of the music that is there. Let's take a song called Sunday's Yellow off the record. I started that record, this is a good example of that, because I started that record actually with the drums and the piano melody. So I just had drums and a piano melody at first, and that was all I had. And then I recorded the bass track and kind of sat with it for a little bit, and I wanted it to sound more grand. And I actually got some advice from my mom. She listened to it, and she was like, you need some horns on here. You know, you need some trumpets. So I was like, hey, you might be right. So I caught up one of my friends. His name is Farnell Newton. And
wait, what? Farnell Newton from Portland, Oregon.
Yep,
he's correct. My neighbor. I just moved here from Portland in November.
That's so
I'm
wild.
Sorry,
yeah, Farnell.
That's crazy. I didn't know that was Farnell on that track.
Yeah, Farnell and I have known each other for a while. And we kind of send music back and forth from time to time. Yeah, so I reached out to him.
He's toured with Jill Scott as her trumpet player, and he's worked with Bootsy Collins.
Correct, man. He's a phenomenal trumpet player. Yeah, I asked him, I reached out to him, and he was like, for sure. And exactly what he sent me back was like perfect. It was just absolutely perfect.
When you get to the point where all the elements are together and you need to sort of pull it into its final form, what would you say you're going for? How do you know when enough is enough?
That's the key question for artists. Sometimes you don't know. You know, because you're like, you wonder if you need more or if you're doing too much. And I usually press play and let the track loop, like be on a continuous loop. And I keep listening to it. And, you know, after 15 minutes of listening to it, sometimes things stand out to you. Sometimes it feels like I don't need to add anything else. And sometimes you feel like, hey, a vocal needs to go there, or there needs to be a part in this section here. And they kind of pop out to you the more you listen to it. But for me, I feel like if I play it continuously and I feel like I don't need to add anything else, it just feels like it's done. It feels good. I just leave it. I leave it, because you can sit there and nitpick at it all day and add and change. But sometimes you just have to know, like, it feels good. Let me leave it where it's at. And enjoy it. Mm-hmm.
Could we just take the Stateside theme as an example? I wanted to know what you start with. Do you remember the first recorded piece that you laid down?
It was a process creating a theme. It actually it started with about five ideas. From those five ideas, the Stateside staff gave me, you know, feedback on all five, but there was two in particular that they liked. And then from there, we just kind of chiseled the idea until it became something that worked well for the show. It was very challenging because I've never created music that way, especially under certain time constraints. So it was very interesting, but it was fun. It was a lot of fun to do. The most difficult thing with creating the theme was, you know, I've never created music for, you know, someone to just, you know, I know it sounds weird because I write rhymes, but in the news realm is kind of interesting because there's so many different topics that you talk about. So to create one piece of music that's kind of neutral for different topics that you talk about is kind of a little bit difficult to do. When you're creating it, but so I had to try different ideas to see what works, you know.
Something that works equally well in like a very serious breaking news situation, or possibly a very sad story, or something with a little more levity in it.
Yeah.
Well, we think it totally works.
Yeah, it does, man. Like I listen to the show a lot, and it makes me smile because it's like, wow. Like, and regardless of what you talk about, it still like feels hopeful, even if it is like a serious story. It always ends like with a question or like, what's gonna happen next, you know? So I kind of like the vibe of how it works with the show.
Well, KT, thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you so much for all your work.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Kendall Tucker performs as 14KT. His latest release is called For My Sanity. That's our show for today. Tomorrow on Stateside, we look at the rift that's growing between labor unions over Medicare for All.
I think describing the candidates' positioning on this as subtle would be a massive understatement.
I'm April Baer. We'll have that for you, plus a whole lot more. Thanks for listening. We'll catch up with you on Friday.